Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk about your automobile and maybe about summer road tripping with Jim Ward. Jim's a retired service manager for Smart Motors Toyota in Madison. He was with the company for 36 years. If you're having problems with your car, maybe you wonder what needs fixing, we certainly want to hear from you. Maybe you have questions about what to do before you go out on a summer road trip. Join in. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. It's great to have a chance to talk with you one last time before I go on my own long, unending road trip out of here.
Well, it's great. It's great to share this moment with you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about summer road tripping just to begin with. I was thinking about my last road trip, and the thing that I did was I went over to the Toyota Motors and said, I'm going on a road trip, and I want my car to make it and there and back, and let's just give it a once-over. So that's what I did, and that's probably good advice for a lot of people, but are there other things we ought to be thinking about?
Well, you know, of course, what we want to think about is the playlist and the snacks. You know, that's the important stuff. But it can all go downhill pretty quickly if something goes wrong. And so, it is important to take it in and maybe you do your own maintenance. Maybe you work on your own car, and that's fine. If you do it all yourself, you know, there are just things though that you might not think about that can really make or break a trip. I mean, you know, the most common things that we see in breakdowns typically are going to be related to tires and batteries. But there are lots of things that can happen beyond a breakdown that can be frustrating or make things feel dangerous real quickly. And one of those has to do with visibility. Do all your lights work? If we get one of those sudden thunderstorm warning periods where it's very dark out all of a sudden, you know, having all your lights work, having good wipers that can clear the windshield so you can see and be seen, can suddenly become really critical. So there are lots of little things, but taking it in to have it inspected or if you do it yourself, keep being mindful of it, making a list of all the things the tires, the fluids, the belts, checking all your lights. It's very important that you do that before you leave on the road trip so that you don't end up in the middle of somewhere without any assistance.
Yeah, it's all good advice. I was thinking about the inside of the windshield. One of the things that I notice is that inside, I don't smoke. There's nothing going on there, but you get a film. You can get a film on the inside of that windshield, and it especially is a problem, I think, at night when you've got lights. Somehow that film really makes things miserable for you.
Yeah, and we call that vinyl sweat. There is something that comes off of the material of the dash, and exactly as you're describing it, fewer and fewer people smoke, thank goodness. But you know, if you were a child of the 60s and 70s as I was, you can remember that often riding with the folks meant there was a blue haze in the car. But even without that film, and as you said, at night, that can really, you can start to think you're having cataracts or something because the windshield breaks up the light so poorly. So cleaning the windshield on the outside is important. And you might not even notice that film during the daytime. But, it's something, and you don't really need any special cleaners, regular glass cleaner, the same thing you use on the outside, you can use on the inside. It will take it off. There's no special solvent or anything to get it off of there. But that is a known entity and can definitely be annoying for night driving.
Wondering about loading the vehicle too and towing. I mean, how do you know if you've overloaded? I've seen some vehicles on the road that look to me like they were overloaded with all they've got on the top of the car, and you look in as you go by, the inside is packed to the gills.
There sure are many different techniques of getting your stuff from here to there in and out of vehicle. Goodness gracious. I mean, beyond the summer road trips, we've all probably seen the car with with a mattress just strapped on the roof with the windows open and the straps going right, you know, across the inside of the roof. Hopefully it stayed on there. You know, the more you put on the top of the roof of a vehicle, there are car top carriers, the more wind resistance you create. So you're going to lose a little bit of gas mileage by doing that. But sometimes that's the only way to get everything you need for the beach or the cabin or wherever you're going. But you want to be very, very careful when you're using a rooftop carrier. You know, be careful that where you mount it is mounted properly so that it's not going to scratch your car or damage anything. Make sure that all of the straps and all of the retainers are very tight, because, you know, it can be pretty catastrophic if you're someone that's behind one of those things that come loose going down the road. When it comes to towing, you know, you want to make sure that your vehicle is rated right. The placard on the driver's door jamb has got GVRW stickers that tell various specifications you need to know, and one of them is what the total weight your vehicle can handle in tow is. And when it comes to towing, if you're not experienced with towing, it's good to do some practices. You don't want to just take off towing something the first time. You know, go out on some side roads, go in some parking lots, try some maneuvers. You know, it's one thing to tow something like a travel trailer, but if it's a trailer that you're loading yourself, and again, you're new to this, the trailers become unstable when there's more weight in the back of the trailer. So the heavy things you want to pack at the front of the trailer, it helps the trailer, prevents some unnecessary swaying that may occur if you have too much weight at the back of a trailer. Those are things that you really, really want to nail down well before your trip. You know, goodness gracious, we've had some incredible tense discussions just over the packing of a trunk for a trip, as you can imagine. So the more involved it gets, the more places you're going to pack things on the roof and a trailer and everything else, the more you need to have a plan well ahead of time. And anybody else that's involved in a trip, if, you know, spouses and stuff, you want to have some agreements on what's going where. Those are definitely not last minute things to try to accomplish.
Yeah, and you might, on a trailer, I'm speaking here from experience now, driving, towing my brother's car, my brother's boat, and he hadn't checked the wheel bearings on the trailer, and we had the wheel bearings go out on one of the, you know, wheels.
Oh, goodness. Sure.
You know, and that was, we were lucky because we found a shop that was able to handle it, and really ran to another garage some miles away to get some get the materials that they needed, and so that was a lesson well learned too.
Right, and you may have been lucky. I mean, you know, there's no guarantee that somebody's going to have the parts. They may have to order them. Now, I'm not sure that during the two or three summer months that you can actually take a trip from southern Wisconsin to northern Wisconsin and not see a boat beside the road with one tire off and probably a bearing failed. I have seen that so many times. Yeah, the bearings need to be packed, and they're not forgiving if you forget.
No, they are not. Well, tires, anything to say about tires? I mean, you want them at the proper inflation, and you want tires that are going to last.
Sure, you sure do. And you know, you want tires that are properly inflated. You want tires that are in good enough condition. You want to know what kind of shape your tires are in. You know, if you take your car in for a checkup sometime in the spring or early summer, they may give you some feedback and give you a report, a maintenance report on your car, and they may tell you your tires look pretty good. They're at, you know, 4 or 5 30 seconds. You're probably going to want to replace them in the fall before snow. And that may all be true, but if you go down the road with tires that are 4 or 5 30 seconds of an inch, which is still legal and still has pretty good tread, keep in mind, if you get into really wet conditions with a lot of rain that's just coming down in buckets and inches per hour, you're going to have some issues with traction. You're going to have some hydroplaning issues with tires that are like that. That's not to say you necessarily must replace those tires before that trip, but be aware of what you've got and how it's going to react in specific conditions so that you can decide to slow down when it's raining real heavy if you don't quite have the deepest tread, or maybe that's when you're going to take your rest break during that heavy rain. But, you know, so that's very important. And the condition of the tires, you know, last summer I replaced the tires on a travel trailer. They didn't have a lot of miles, really only a few thousand miles on them, but they were 10 years old. And tires do have an age. So regardless of how few miles you may put on your car, and more people are able to you know, work at home and put fewer miles on, those tires still have an age limit when they should be replaced. And it varies by manufacturer. So you can look up your manufacturer, look up Bridgestone or Goodyear or whatever, and see what they say for years. But that's also something else to heed and be aware of. Sidewalls start to crack. The sun breaks down the rubber and breaks down the tire, regardless of whether the tread is worn out or not. So important things. Lastly, it's just how your tires wear. You know, it used to be that you'd either have to wait until the tires got really uneven wear, or you noticed that your steering wheel was starting to pull to one side, or it wasn't, the steering wheel's not straight when the car is going straight anymore, to realize that your alignment is off. An awful lot of shops anymore have drive-through devices where you don't have to pay to drive through, and it can give you a pretty good idea if the alignment's off or not. The most miles that we put on our car in a short period of time is on a summer road trip. And so, you don't want to find out at the end of the road trip that the alignment was off and you got a lot more excessive uneven wear than you expected and than you would have noticed in your daily commuting and short trip driving. So that's something else. You may want to drive through one of those and find out if your alignment's off before you go as well.
Yeah, very, very good point. Well, we have lots of callers online with questions, so let's go first to Mike and Lac des Flambeaux. We'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, Larry, and I want to tell you how sad I am that this is your last day. I really will miss you.
Well, it's not my last day. It's just my last day with Jim Ward. I'm done on June 30th, which is next week, Tuesday.
Okay, well, I'm going to miss your lovely voice.
Thank you.
I have a question. My question is, I own a 2010 Lexus that I bought with 80,000 miles 10 years ago. It now has 350,000 miles. And I was told by a mechanic that if I used an oil additive, it's called BG product, that it'll extend the miles and I'll get over 400. I want to find out your opinion. Do oil additives work? Do they really help the automobile run? And I'd like to hear your opinion. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Jim, what do you think?
I'm not a huge fan of additives. You know, there are a few instances. There are products that I've talked about Seafoam from time to time, which is something that primarily I recommend you put in your gas if your vehicle is going to sit for a long time, or if you store gas in a gas can for machines. That helps the gas remain more stable and keeps it from breaking down. That same product can also be put in engine oil and does help clean up the engine a little bit. But really, you're far, far better off to change your oil on the proper interval and to use the proper oil for the car. If people do that, you know, I do think there's a difference with synthetic oil. More and more cars, almost any modern cars manufactured now, are recommended to use synthetic oil. But back before that was the case, you could see the difference when you worked in a shop and you took the valve cover, the top cover off an engine that always had synthetic oil versus non-synthetic oil. The problem I have with additives is that they... It can go too far. Pretty soon, they want you to change every fluid in your vehicle and put these additives in, and it really isn't necessary. If you change the fluids when they're supposed to be changed, by and large, you can avoid and really don't need to use additives, short of long-term fuel storage. And that's where I think, Seafoam, there's lots of different products out there that do fuel stabilization, but that's one area where I think it's important.
Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. We'll get to Jerry and Kakana in just a second. Our quick reminder, our guest today, Jim Ward, service manager, retired as service manager of Smart Motors and Toyota, with the company 36 years. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your automobile today with Jim Ward, retired from Smart Motors Toyota. He was the service manager there. He was with the company 36 years. Lots of callers online. So now we go to Jerry and Kakana. Jerry, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks, Larry and Jim. I have my question is kind of, you see a lot of all-wheel drives. From what I understand, that the four-wheel drive is superior because it at least puts power on two wheels, where the all-wheel drive only puts it on one. But I have a 2005 RAV4, and in the winter, if it's a hard-packed snow and I step on it, it only seems to be, it'll spin like it's only a two-wheel drive car, and it seems to be spinning from the front. What can I do about that to get a better traction?
The 05 RAV4 should have traction control, and the traction control, when you at the very start of wheel spin, the traction control should kick in, and that then allows other wheels that have better traction to take over and be the driving wheel. All-wheel drive systems tend to be, as compared to a straight-up four-wheel drive, tend to be more economical, and in most instances will get you through. But if you really are in deep snow, hard-packed snow, the big difference is that four-wheel drive will, a true basic four-wheel drive system will allow you to engage both the front and rear axles and all four wheels turning at together. They have to turn together. You can't even engage that kind of a system on pavement. You have to be able to turn the vehicle. I mean, you can, but it's really not advised. You need to be on a surface where it can slip. So four-wheel drive and that kind of traction is for the worst of conditions, which is not usually what people need, which is why they've gone with all-wheel drive, which can automatically switch back and forth, give you better fuel economy because it's less of a, it's an easier mechanical system, a lighter system. In your 05 RAV4, though, your traction control should be preventing that wheel spin and distributing the drive to other wheels.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you very much for calling. So if he is, I would guess, I suppose he'd go to his Toyota dealer and check out if there's something seemingly wrong.
I know people who turn traction control off because it annoys them, because it seems like it cuts your power. So, in those conditions, that's exactly where you want the traction control. Although sometimes it can seem, I felt that way myself. If I come to a steep hill in the wintertime, a lot of snow on, it's like, I know how to drive in the winter. I just want to drive up just like I did in 1972. But traction control, does help keep the vehicle safe in a lot of different conditions that might come up as a surprise and such. So, if that's the case, I would leave the traction control on.
John in Eisenstein, your turn now. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, first off, we're going to miss you.
Oh, thank you, John.
My question is, and your guest already kind of touched on it a little bit. I have a Toyota 4Runner, a 2011, and a 2023 Tacoma. And my question has to do with intervals of oil change, and do I have to change the transmission fluid or not? My 2023 doesn't even have a dipstick for the transmission fluid.
Right.
10,000 miles on oil change for me just seems too long. So I'm interested in your guest's advice.
A couple of different areas there. Yeah, that transmission is a sealed transmission. It uses a synthetic transmission fluid, which is typically considered a lifetime fluid. They don't have an interval to change it. That's not to say it can't be changed, but, I've seen vehicles make 100,000 miles and really not have problems with them. The transmissions are pretty well built and pretty dependable, and that interval has been realistic. I typically am a big fan of recommending staying with manufacturers' recommendations on fluid changes and most other maintenance. But, John, I've got to agree with you. 10,000 miles is theoretically okay. I mean, the oils may last that long. But one of the problems is it would probably be fine for the first 50,000 miles. But at some point, we were talking to Jerry earlier, Mike earlier, had a Lexus with 350,000 miles. By the time you get that many miles on a vehicle, if you keep it that long, there's a good chance that it burns some oil. And if you're not used to checking oil, and most people don't, in 10,000 miles, you could use enough oil to do some engine damage. And so that's one of my main reasons for feeling that interval is simply too long. I don't believe people will check their oil in that interval sufficiently as the engine gets higher mileage and may use oil. If anything does start to go wrong, a leak or something, I feel like John does. I think 5,000 miles is as long as I typically would go. And we did see problems with some Toyotas that did a few different years and models that developed oil consumption problems. And when people weren't checking it or expecting to have to check it off more than 10,000 miles, their engines would get low on oil and warning lights come on. And so, yep, that is the last thing you want to see. So I agree with John. I think 10,000 is too long. I think it should be a 5,000-mile interval for most vehicles.
John, there you go. Thank you so much. Cheryl in Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Yeah, I have a little mystery going on. As soon as I turn the key on my car, the yellow dash light comes on. But if I put the lights on or pull up the emergency brake, it goes off. Do you have any idea what's going on? And the car runs fine.
Well, Cheryl, I'm not sure what's going on, but what yellow light are we talking about? Is it an icon? What is it shaped like?
Well, it's right on the dash.
And what car?
Right in the center.
What's your car?
What was that?
What automobile do you drive? I'm sorry.
It's a 2007 Chevrolet LS, and it's been the perfect car.
And it's always done this.
What did you say?
And it's always done this?
No. No, it just started a couple of weeks ago. And I know a guy that's been a mechanic for 40 years. He doesn't have a clue.
You know, I would need to be looking at this. I'm not sure what light we're talking about. I think you might be talking about a check engine light. I mean, if it's a light, if it's the shape of a motor, of an engine, and if you're talking about when you turn the key to start the car, but you have not started it yet, that light is on?
I didn't do that. I just usually, you know, start it right away.
Okay. And so it stays on for a bit after the car starts?
Well, all the while, unless I put the lights on or pull up the emergency brake, then it goes off.
A mystery.
You know, you do have a mystery. I'll tell you what, I that's one I would have to put some eyeballs on. And not knowing just what light it is, not sure what's going on here with that one. I love a good mystery, and I wish I had an answer for you, Cheryl. But, and someone out there is going to know, but I don't know what light it is. Normally what you mentioned when you turn your lights on or you pull your handbrake, when you pull the handbrake, normally like daytime running lights will dim down so you could like not shine them in your neighbor's house when you're trying to do something early in the morning. But yeah, I have to say, I don't have enough information here. I'm not sure what that mystery light is about.
Oh, sorry, Cheryl. It is a mystery indeed. Well, you might want to check with another mechanic, although if you've got somebody who's been doing it 40 years, it's a surprise that person wouldn't know for sure.
Yeah, you'd think. But then again, you never know. I've been in the business 40 years, and I'm sure there are plenty of things I haven't seen, including this one.
Okay.
So, yep, another set of eyes, another perspective will probably figure it out.
Kathy in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, first of all, thank you for your service. And second of all, I have a 2009 Honda Pilot, and it's an all-wheel drive, and it's been having a problem. It's got close to 200,000 miles, not exactly there yet, but it kind of has almost like a hesitation, almost as though the transmission's flipping. Now, when I got the car, I assumed none of the mean maintenance was done, so I did the flush, the Honda flush, which is drain and fill three times, and even it put an additive that a mechanic suggested that would help, and it still seems to do that. Now, it could be the transmission, but I don't know if there's anything else that I could try to rule out, because I know Hondas are pretty good for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know that they've had a transmission problem. So it's done this from the time you bought it. It's always done it, and you did that service, and that service, the transmission service, or the drain and fill and an additive have had no effect on it. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so, well, and you know, this is something, I'm not, I'm not sure I understand exactly what the symptom is. You say a hesitation. Is this from a dead stop when you go to leave a stoplight that it doesn't seem to want to go right away, or this is at the shifts, during the transmission shift specifically, you notice something?
During the shifts, like going down the highway, you go up a hill, and there's like a little, almost like a kind of a shudder, and then it carries on like normal, but then it's like sometimes on acceleration it'll do that too, but it's usually at the higher speeds. Now I don't know if that's what they called the Honda juggle, or if that was something else, you know.
Well, it kind of sounds like you're describing. If it's a little bit of a shudder, like you went over a little bit of a speed bump or something, that shudder is typically caused by a torque converter shutter, and typically is not a breakdown issue. And I know Honda and many other manufacturers tried to address it with software updates. They would the transmission that operates the computer that operates the transmission, they would come up with a different software that would change the shift points a little bit, make it less likely to do that. It does kind of sound like that's what you're describing, you know, and I guess what I would recommend is calling a Honda dealer, have your vehicle identification number, the VIN number for your car ready, and give that to them and just have them check and see if there are any bulletins or updates for the transmission controls that, because that was a fairly common thing in 09 for Honda, Toyota, a number of other companies to tweak the transmissions. They designed the transmission to give the best gas mileage, to be the most efficient, but then a lot of customers didn't like some of the characteristic feel they had, so they changed it to give it a better feel, and it sounds like that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, it does. Kathy, thank you, and good luck. Give a call, but have that VIN number ready. It's a long one, for sure.
Yeah.
Mike in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. My question is about air conditioners on the car, and how cold should the air coming out of the vents be to, as an indicator of whether or not you have proper amount of cooling in there?
Typically, the coldest that you're going to get out of the vent is going to be in the range of about 48 degrees. Now, I've seen vehicles that will put out colder than that, but it's also going to depend on what the ambient air temperature is. So, for example, if it's 70 degrees out, you may get 48 degrees out of the dash, but if we get up to 90 degrees, that's going to go to 54. If we get to 100 degrees, 59. So it does depend on how hot it is out, but typically 48 is what we're looking for.
Yeah, there you go, Mike. Thank you. Jared in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jared.
Hey, Larry, how's it going?
Good, appreciate the call.
Appreciate you, too. Thanks for your service to public radio. So just a question about my front driver brake caliper. I had purchased a car, private party sale, drove fine during the test drive. On the way home, the caliper stuck, so I took it apart, greased up the slide pins, and drove it a bit. It stuck again, so I took it apart again, put it back together, and now it's driving fine. Is there something I need to look out for? I've ruled out the master cylinder because it's only that one brake caliper.
Did it look like the caliper slides were corroded badly, or were they fairly clean?
No, so the top, it's an 06 Liberty, and the top pin had a rubber sleeve, and it looked like it may have been cracked, so I replaced that sleeve. But after the first reassemble, it stuck again, and the piston went back in just fine, and now it seems to be running fine. I just need to know if there's something I need to watch out for.
Well, it's certainly something I would keep an eye on. I mean, one of the things that can happen when a vehicle is sold private party is it may have sat for a while, and that brakes don't like sitting around, especially in Wisconsin. And what you described with the torn boot, that boot's job, of course, is to keep salt and dirt and things out so that it doesn't stick. So, it is the fact that it's stuck a second time and really don't know why just tells me we got to keep an eye on it. Sure, it could be a master cylinder, it could be the caliper, but it's, in that order, it's less likely to be a master cylinder. The most likely thing is exactly what you addressed, the mechanical things right at the brake. But this is one where you want to keep an eye on it. I'm going to hope for you that it was just that the vehicle sat because they were selling it, wasn't being used much. Things rusted up a bit, and now that you've got it all freed up and moving, it's probably going to be fine.
Jared, there you go, and thank you very much for calling. By the way, we have some open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Give a call. Mike in Fall Creek emailed, say he owns a 2023 Toyota Tundra Hybrid. Mike was told that the transfer case and differential fluids should be changed at 35,000 miles. What are your thoughts on that requirement?
I don't think that's a Toyota recommendation. I would like, you know, if I were Mike, I would be asking the shop recommending that, why they think that is the correct interval. I don't believe that Toyota has that frequent an interval for that. And again, you know, fluid changes are the kind of thing where, there have been so few times. I can only think of once or twice in my career where a given year model vehicle had a specific problem and we would recommend changing fluid more frequently than whatever the manufacturer said. So it's rare that would be necessary. And things like those driveline fluids, differential and transfer case fluids, are a gear lube that's a very stable fluid. It handles what it does very well. So, you know, yeah, I'm not sure why they would recommend that. It's more frequent than, I can't tell you off the top of my head if it even has an interval, but I know it would be much longer than that. So, you know, sometimes it just falls under the category, well, it'd be good insurance. And it is good insurance to make sure your fluids are all good, but I don't think it's necessary. I wouldn't do it, and I would want to know if they've had specific experience with the Fat Tundra and why they recommend that. Haven't seen that myself.
Vern in Boyd says that sun visors in most cars are too darn small to protect your eyes from the sun. He considers it an industry-wide flaw, and they are smaller than they used to be. Or seemingly so.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the vehicle. I mean, in our house, you know, we have a little Prius C, tiny little thing. The sun visor seems like it's not much more than my eyebrow. I also have a Silverado, and the sun visor on that is absolutely huge. You know, they do make various accessory add-ons that you can clip onto a sun visor to increase its size, but obviously, really careful with that kind of a thing. If it falls off, you're going down the road, you just don't want something like that, you know, impairing your vision as opposed to helping it by keeping the sun out. But there are plenty of aftermarket things you can add in there. I don't know, you know, that the manufacturers are, they've got to deal with the room that they have in a given vehicle. You know, great big trucks have great big sun visors, tiny cars have tiny ones, and otherwise sunglasses and add-ons are about all we can do.
Dan emailed to say he recently had a check engine light come on because of a plugged catalytic converter on his 2020 Ford F-150, wondering what he could do to resolve this and prevent this from happening again. He had a plugged catalytic converter, and it caused the check engine light to come on.
Sure. That is unusual. You know, catalytic converter is a device in your exhaust system. Supposed to clean up the hydrocarbons that didn't get burned during the combustion process, so what comes out the tailpipes cleaner. They typically do that very well. They don't typically plug up unless something is going wrong with the engine. If it's burning oil or dumping something into that catalytic converter that it shouldn't be, even a really rich fuel mixture would take a long time to plug it up. So it seems like there's something else going on with that vehicle. I would be monitoring it for oil consumption or oil, excessive fluids, some kind or another, getting into that exhaust. That's just, it's not a common failure, and there's something else causing it. You know, and my best guess is it's probably burning oil.
Laura emailed to say she's taking her 2016 Toyota Sequoia XLE from Wisconsin to Virginia and back. That's over the 4th of July. The vehicle has 147,000 miles on it. She recently put new tires on, and she had the oil changed. Are there any other factors Linda should take into consideration before heading on the road?
Well, I would be surprised when you had the oil change if they didn't do what we call a multi-point inspection. They just check all of the fluid levels. They look at belts and hoses. Check. Obviously, you got brand new tires, and they probably talk to you about alignment on that. But if you didn't have a multi-point inspection, I would have that done. There are plenty of other things, from your wipers to checking all your lights and making sure they're working. You know, all, as I said, all the fluids, belts and hoses, those are all these minimum things that, you'll want to check. There are tests they can run on the battery to tell if it looks like it's going to fail soon. So those are all parts of a typical multi-point inspection. And if that wasn't done with the oil change, I would recommend having that done before that trip.
Yeah. And sometimes with the bill, you get, they say on the bill, I know with Toyota, I've gotten a multi-point inspection that they've done just when I was doing something simple like the oil change. So maybe if you go back and look at the slip that you paid for the business that you got, you'll see that maybe they did do that inspection. It's worth a look anyway.
I would think so. Yeah, most shops do it and do it at no charge. And, you know, part of the reason they do it is simply because it isn't going to look very good for me and my shop if you had your car in yesterday and the next day something fails that you're going to think, you should have noticed that. And maybe, you know, just doing an oil change, maybe there wasn't a chance you should notice that. But I'll tell you what, if you run a car shop and something fails the next day, that's going to be the question in somebody's mind. So usually they do those inspections on every visit. They do them free. So, yeah, I would take a look at your paperwork. You might very well have a report there telling you they've already done it and everything's good.
Keith in Davenport, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Keith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got a question. I've got a 2010 Chevy Silverado. Purchased it secondhand about 4 months ago. Seemed like it ran great. Next thing you know, I just had the I had it on accessory, so the vehicle's turned off. And instantly, pretty much, it said, hey, low battery, start vehicle. But that was kind of weird, so I started it and thought, okay, I'll get the battery replaced. Took it into a shop. They called me up and said, hey, we checked your battery. It's great. There's no battery issue. Oh, okay. Well, that's weird, but okay. They literally brought it out to their shop. I went to go start it. Wouldn't start. Nothing. You didn't hear a click, no starter, no nothing. And he's like, well, we just had it out here. We just parked it here. I'm like, it won't. They hooked up the code reader to it, and it just had tons of communication errors, communication this, communication that. Wouldn't start. I disconnected the battery, resetting the computer, I suppose. Reconnected the battery, starts right up. All my lights are good, no problems. Runs fine, we're good, we're great. I'll go park, come back out, and won't start.
Ugh.
Nothing.
Oh, frustrating.
There are times when I'm driving, and all of a sudden, it'll say my stable thing, my traction control kicks off. There's been times I'll be driving, and all of a sudden, all my gauges quit working.
Mm.
And I'm assuming it's a ground problem somewhere. I did replace the ground cable, and that did not take care of the problem.
Well, Keith, I'll tell you, I had a so similar an experience. I tell you what, I bought a used Silverado a few years ago, 2016. I had almost the exact same experience you did. I mean, it would not start at the strangest times, and ultimately I started looking and I found out that on my particular truck, Chevy had five different bulletins about connection problems, connection at the ground cable, a ground connection here and there that can cause those symptoms. You mentioned about all the communication codes. Those communication codes typically are caused by not enough voltage getting to the computers. So you know, you're right in thinking we've either got a connection problem here. I went through all those bulletins. I did every one of the repaired every one of those connections, and the problem kept happening intermittently. It ended up being the battery in my truck. And the thing is, I've tested thousands and thousands of batteries in my life and through my career. And most typically, the modern battery testers especially are very good at telling you, even if a battery is good, if it's about to fail, but not always. There's a type of battery failure that is like an open circuit, an intermittent open circuit that can occur within the battery. It's like a connection problem, and you have to catch that red-handed. And, I mean, even though it may not have started a second ago, simply hooking up a meter, it may correct and test good. And I probably had that battery in my truck tested and tested it myself a few times. I had it probably tested 12 times before it finally caught red-handed, and it was a battery that had failed. You know, so you could check and see if on your 2010 Silverado, there's a few other bulletins on connections, because there were five of them on mine, but I did all of them, and that wasn't the problem in the end. So, I just got a hunch. I got a feeling you got the same battery problem that I had, you know, I may be wrong. It might be one of those connection problems, but whatever it is, as you're learning, you have to catch it absolutely red-handed doing it right that moment, or you're not going to get to the bottom of it.
So maybe replace the battery and the problem goes away, possibly?
Possibly. You know what? Before that happened, before I did that, before the battery failed, I bought one of those little jump packs. They're really handy. They're small. You can use it to recharge your cell phone. You can use it to charge all kinds of things, and you can use it to jump start your vehicle. That I was always able to start it with that when the battery would act up, and you know, so you know, I don't know how to tell you to do that. Those are handy to have around regardless. It would help you keep it started until one day it acts up when you have a tester nearby and can catch it.
Keith, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest, retired service manager from Smart Motors Toyota, 36 years and counting of experience with all kinds of vehicles. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your automobile today with Jim Ward, a retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. It's great to have him back to talk with you. And Dean in Waupaca has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Dean.
Hi. I had a 2019 GMC, and I bought a new 2025 GMC because the 2019, I'd had problems with the transmission. I don't know if you know about that, big deal. But so I traded in, and I was talking to them about it, and they told me that I can't change the brakes on it because I got to bring it in, and they got to hook it up to the computer. I've been a maintenance man for 30 years, and I'm wondering, and I heard that John Deere actually got sued from farmers out in Nebraska for having that where they had to have a serviceman come out and restart their tractors. And I guess that lawsuit went through where John Deere has to change something so that the farmers can maintain their own tractors. And I was wondering if GMC was going to be falling into suit with that, where, you know, you pay $60,000 for a vehicle and you can't even touch it. And I'm a maintenance man.
Yeah.
Sure. It seems outrageous, and it is. You know, the right to maintain your own vehicle, work on your own vehicle, is a burgeoning subject. And this isn't new. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, in my own career many years ago, some manufacturers are far more proprietary about their software. There's a manufacturer I worked for that you couldn't replace a power window switch without downloading the new software for the body electric computer to make it work. It's a simple replacement. It, you know, if you work on vehicles, you pop the switch out of the door panel, you know, a connector goes on it, you should be done. But no, you know, that manufacturer product. What usually happens in these instances is that someone at an independent shop or, you know, that makes the type of scan tools that the GM dealer would use, the GMC dealer would use to connect and download this new software for the computer, they'll make what's called ghost software. It's the same software that's already in your computer that'll operate the brakes just perfectly fine after you do brake work on it. But it basically, they call it ghost software, that it basically tells the computer that, oh yeah, this is the new version and everything works fine. You know, it is very frustrating. Manufacturers do that on different systems, it's just a proprietary nature of the business. They would like you to have to come to them for everything, but as you mentioned, you know, consumers generally are not happy to stand for that, and sometimes it results in a lawsuit, but usually it results in someone just finding a workaround, such as the Ghost software. So, you know, you may very well find that you can do the brake work yourself and have to take it to an independent shop, maybe if you don't want to buy the scanner and load that software, just to have somebody, basically it's like clearing a code, just telling it's got the new software and then everything works fine. But yeah, it's going to be a big issue going down the road as vehicles become more and more difficult, and you know, they make it sometimes intentionally difficult to be able to work on them yourself.
There you go, Dean. Look up Ghost software for that and see, or go to an independent and see what, find one that has that capability. Norbert and Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Norbert.
Yes, I got a problem with my sensors. And well, first I want to thank you for your show. It's very helpful.
Thank you.
And yeah, I got my sensors aren't working, or some sensor ain't working right. I got the brake light comes on and some other lights come on. It's like a Christmas tree. And my cruise control don't work. And I've had it in the shop several times. They replaced parts and stuff. And it's like an unending thing. And one shop said it could cost me over $1,000 just to fix the stupid lights.
Norbert, what year and model car are we talking about?
It's a Subaru. I think it's a 2015.
A 2015 Subaru. Well, you mentioned the cruise control doesn't work. That the only good news that I can tell you right off the bat is that that's probably only because the warning light's on. That's typically when a brake warning light is on, by design, the cruise control will not work. The engineers don't want it to be in cruise control if they think maybe your brakes aren't going to work. So the one bright light, the fact that, this has been worked on a number of times and they're not getting to the bottom of the problem is one of the most frustrating things any of us can experience. And I don't have a particular insight in your 15 Subaru on what is going wrong there. Often, when a shop looks at a vehicle, they're looking at codes that tell them, their diagnostic codes that tell them where the problem is. And, it's often a case of, well, we really aren't going to know anything else until we replace this component that it says isn't working right or isn't getting a signal. But the component may not have failed. It may not be working right because it doesn't have a good ground connection somewhere. Or, and often these kind of problems where you've taken it back in and taken it in and they're doing what the computer says, replace this, replace that, really comes down to a more, basic electrical problem of a connection somewhere that's fooling the diagnostics. That's not much consolation when you're paying the bill, but it is probably going to come down to that. And it's going to come down to finding a really good electrical guy that knows his stuff and knows how to track down where all the grounds are and whether or not the system is really have the base structural power and ground that it needs to be able to work right. So, Norbert, you're just in one of the most frustrating situations a car owner can be in there. But, that it's going to take some basic pin check diagnostics by somebody with good electrical background to get to the bottom of that.
Now, Norbert, there you go. Gary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Hi. So I have a 2015 Highlander with the V6, and I'm very happy with it. I mean, it's really... I just love it. I've got 220,000 on it, and it still runs like a champ. But sooner or later, I'm thinking about another vehicle, and I'm thinking about the possibility of going with a hybrid. But I'm kind of wondering what's the tow capacity with the hybrid on a Highlander? Is it as good? Is it And I'm just not sure on how that would work because the V6.
Gas, yes,
been top performer.
Yeah, and they typically are a different towing capacity. Hybrids typically have been lower, although they've been improving that. I do not know off the top of my head what the capacity, towing capacity of a brand new Highlander hybrid is. But there's a difference. It's a matter of checking those specifications and find out if it's going to fit what you need to tow. The hybrids are great for the versatility with great economy, yet still having a gas engine as opposed to an all-electric vehicle. As with anything, what are you going to tow? What are the specifications for it? I apologize, Gary. I don't know off the top of my head what the new one is, but it's going to be a little less for a hybrid.
It'll be a little less, Gary. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, our guest today, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota and was with the company 36 years. And as you're hearing, he knows a whole lot about cars. And it's always great to have him with us. He and I have been doing this together for a long time, and I always look forward to having him on. Questions for him, of course, give a call or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. We are going to take a look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Jim Ward. He'll be with us for another half hour. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be right back. Taking a look at your automobile today with Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison, with the company 36 years. Great to have him back. Lots of callers online. There's emails galore. So let's go to the phones and Jared in Stoughton. Jared, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim. Glad to be on the air with you. I have a 2016 Jeep Compass that when, say, I'm at highway speeds and I have to slow down to, like, a roundabout or something where you get under 25 miles an hour, as you get around it and you put your foot back on the gas, there's, like the transmission is trying to figure out which gear to be in. And there's clunking and kind of hesitations. And to kind of bypass that, you can kind of put your foot into it and really kick it down and go. It's never thrown a code, never thrown an engine light. Not really sure what's going on. I don't know if what your previous caller, you have mentioned something about a software update, if that would apply to this situation.
Well, that is exactly what it sounds like. And again, I don't know. You know, over the years, we were a Toyota dealer. We worked on a lot of different vehicles. I tended to memorize the Toyota bulletins, but many, many manufacturers. I know the Jeep Compass is known for that. Is happens to be one that's known for some of that is typically a software glitch. Low fluid could cause that. There are different things that can cause it, but generally it's a software glitch, and typically manufacturers have come out with software updates to address it. I don't know for sure that that's the case for your 16 Compass. A Jeep dealer would need to look at the VIN number of your vehicle and check and see if it falls into a category for a software update. But that's what I'd recommend checking first. It's a very common condition. The engineers design these transmissions for certain efficiencies, and people just by and large do not like that feel. It's a disconcerting feeling, wondering whether the transmission is failing or is it just searching for something. It's really kind of more of the latter, that it's just trying to figure out the circumstance, getting the right gear. But there's probably a update to correct that.
There you go, Jared. Thank you. Raquel, in Verona, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Thank you so much for all your years in service, first of all.
Thank you.
And, Jim, I'm delighted to have you on the phone. I own a 2017 Highlander, Toyota Highlander, which, like everybody else on the planet, I love. However, recently, I'm listening to the radio, NPR, of course, and it the whole thing just kind of blanks out. The screen goes blank, it kind of cuts out, and it's gone. And I'm just kind of cross noises too. I think it's going to be like $1,300 is what Toyota told me to replace the center panel, like that whole center control panel. What would you suggest I do? I mean, I want to keep the car, of course.
Sure. That's unfortunately, factory sound systems are just crazy expensive to repair. And ultimately, when I find myself in that situation, I typically will buy an aftermarket unit and install it myself. It's not necessarily something that's in everyone's wheelhouse, but places like Best Buy, sell those kind of things, an aftermarket radio that can be put in there that would work. You want to make sure, when you're picking something like that out, it helps to talk to somebody pretty knowledgeable because the radio communicates with the body electric computer. You could pick a radio that maybe does everything you want it to, but doesn't tell you what the outside ambient temperature is. And someone who has got experience in putting an aftermarket unit into a vehicle will know to ask you. They almost interview and ask you, how important is this? How important is that? To make sure they're finding the unit that's going to give you all the features that you still want to have for a reasonable price without losing anything you don't want to lose.
There you go. There you go, Raquel. Appreciate your call very much. Josiah, who's en route to the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Josiah.
Hey, I'm glad to be on the air. This is actually, I started listening recently, and I'm sad to hear that you're retiring, but I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you.
I was curious what you think on the quality of parts from websites like eBay Motors and Rock Auto, because I do all my own service work, and that's where I get my parts.
I've ordered parts from Rock Auto. eBay is, you know, it's like buying used parts. I mean, you always take a little bit of a chance with that. You know, I like Rock Auto a little bit better because I kind of feel like I know who I'm talking to a little bit more that way. But you know, there are certain years and models of vehicles where you kind of learn not to go in the aftermarket for certain parts. The Toyotas don't like aftermarket alternators and starters. Pretty much all the other electrical parts you could put in would be fine. So given that certain years and models of vehicles will have certain caveats like that, you know, there are a couple instances where those may not be an aftermarket part, that may not be a good idea. But by and large, I think they're a great option.
All right. There you go, Josiah. Thank you for calling. Peter in Plymouth, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how you doing, Larry? Great show, man. Love it.
Thank you.
Question I have is I got a 2015 Ram 1500, and it has over 100,000 miles on it, and is it necessary to change all the fluids? Tranny, transfer case, antifreeze, brakes, you know, all that good stuff.
Well, in order of importance, I mean, changing fluids does extend the life of the assemblies that they're in. You know, but in order of importance, you know, changing engine oil is the most important. After that, changing the transmission fluid, it would be the next thing I would consider doing on a vehicle if it's never had it done. Driveline fluids, the antifreeze in the radiator and in the engine, generally less concerned about. You can do inspections on those and determine if they still look like they're okay. And brake fluid is one I hardly ever, you know, unless, and with all of those systems, if something in the system fails, if you have a water pump fail and the bearings went out on it, then it could have, you know, blasted some metal pieces into the cooling system. And after a failure like that, I would flush that fluid definitely. And, you know, for the brake system too, if some kind of breakdown like that happened. But otherwise, I don't see a lot of value in changing brake fluid just for a maintenance interval. Typically, driveline fluids too, like the front rear differential transfer case fluids. But engine oil, transmission fluid, and the antifreeze in the engine radiator are things that I think, you know, the transmission fluid and the antifreeze probably at least every 10 years on most modern vehicles. The engine oil more like 5,000 miles or 6 months. Beyond that, I'd go by how they look.
All right. There you go, Peter. Thank you. Koji in Rhinelander. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry, for having me. Congrats on the show, and thanks so much for your years of service. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jim, I have a question about my 06 4Runner. I just bought the thing. I love it. I put 120,000 miles, and I would really love to see it get to 300. I guess I have a question generally about how best to do that, how best to ensure the life of my vehicle, but then also specifically the lift kit. I bought it. It's got 2-inch spacers on it, and I've been advised that over time that's going to cause some extra mechanical wear on the vehicle, and that I ought to save up for real extended spacers. I guess I'd love to hear your opinion on that, please.
Well, the 4Runner, you know, 4Runners are one of the most trouble-free Toyota models that there ever were, and an 06 is one of those as well. And I've seen plenty of them with lift kits. I wouldn't say that none of them ever had a pinion bearing fail where the drive shaft goes into the differential. When you change the angle, you can cause some wear. But that wasn't something I typically saw as much of a problem on a 2-inch lift. It could happen. You know, part of it, I think, is significant as a 2-inch lift is how you drive it. You can put a 2-inch lift on a vehicle and drive it like a daily driver, never even take it off the road. Or you can put a 2-inch lift on because it gives you extra clearance and go out and use that to its absolute maximum off-roading. The wear, extra wear that you're going to have on something like a pinion bearing is going to be significantly different on the one you take and go off-road on. It's not just a 2-inch lift. It's how the vehicle's used. Beyond that, you know, that an 06 4Runner was not a vehicle I remember needing a lot of babying. In other words, beyond what Toyota recommended for fluid changes and maintenance intervals, none of them, in my experience, ever needed to be increased to a more frequent interval because of a problem with that vehicle. So I would look up Toyota's maintenance recommendations. I would go with that. And, you know, I don't see any reason you wouldn't get 2 to 3 times the miles that are on it now. Great vehicle.
Koji, there you go. You should be able to sort of take a sigh of relief there. You got a good vehicle. Mary Ann in Waukesha. Hi.
Hi. I have a 2011 Dodge Caravan, and when it's 20 degrees or below outside, the engine starts right up, but the shifter lever won't move. When it starts up, there's supposed to be a clicking sound, and then the shifting lever will move. Well, it doesn't make that clicking sound. So do you have any suggestions?
Okay. And when it warms up, it does shift when it warms up.
Yeah, I have to turn the heater on so the interior gets warm.
Yeah, well, vehicles have what's called an interlock system that's supposed to prevent you from being able to shift it into gear unless you've got the brake on. And that typically sometimes is an electrical system that sends a signal from the brake light switch or the brake switch up to a device that pops out of the way so that your shifter will move, or sometimes it's even mechanical. We'll go up there, but something in that system is sticking. You know, it's not likely it's an electrical connection. There's a little detent, little bearing, a little capsule shaped bearing that's supposed to slide in and out and allow it to move. And that probably has gotten sticky. It's possible maybe somebody could lubricate it, but that system needs to be inspected when it's cold and when it's acting up to find out what aspect of it is sticking so it can be lubricated or replaced or adjusted so that it works when you need it to at 20 degrees.
Yeah, and I suppose that means probably taking it to a dealer and letting it sit.
Well, yeah, you know, typically you want to make an appointment when it's in that temperature range and drop it off the night before so they have it there in the morning, because they are going to need to see it doing it to be able to determine what it is. It's typically not a real big deal of a repair for the most part, but yeah, to get to the bottom of it, you need to duplicate it and get it to do it.
Mary Ann? Go and do. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jonathan emailed to say all four of his tires are cupping, though they have not had too much pressure. They are Goodyear tires. Jonathan bought them from Walmart, and his mechanic told him that Goodyear makes tires for Walmart that are not the same quality as sold elsewhere, and he wonders if that's true.
Tire manufacturers do make special tire series for different retailers, so that is true. Doesn't necessarily mean they're better or worse, but yeah, they do make different tires, different specifications. Sometimes they'll make them for a given auto manufacturer. Sometimes they'll do them for a given retailer. Cupping on the tires can have, you know, it can be related to a defect in the tire or the way the tire is going to wear. It can be related sometimes to wheel alignment problems, although not typically. And it can be related to the way you drive as well. Usually it's annoying because it makes a lot of noise and they buzz when they're going down the road, but it's not usually necessarily an indicator of a tire failure. So, you could also probably do some research and do some reviews of that tire and look what people said about it. You may find that lots of people say they cup, and in that case, you could assume it's a manufacturing problem, and there's really nothing you're doing in driving or alignment that's off that's causing it. I don't know that off the top of my head, but you can usually research that a bit and find out what other consumers are saying about them to determine if that's just a bad tire.
Dennis in Two Rivers emailed to say he's frustrated when people claim electric vehicles and other green technologies are problematic. He reminds that internal combustion and connected systems were given a lot of time to improve. And Dennis says green technology is improving as well. Wonders what you think about that.
Well, when vehicles first came out, you know, everybody was using horses and nobody thought this was going to work out very well. I don't know how many people that depend on horses to get around anymore. You know, they're... Green technology is a challenging thing right now. The winds of change can make so much difference on whether it's viable for a manufacturer to go into producing those vehicles. Honda made a big gamble over the last few years in investing into all electric, which has turned out with the winds of fate have blown in such a way that it's caused them one of their first losses in profits in a long time. Not necessarily because it's a bad idea. There's so many factors that are going to determine whether a given new idea is going to take hold or not. You know, I think, you know, that they're great hybrid and electrical vehicles are a great option that need to be out there. but it's always going to be controversial.
Yeah. Barbara in Milwaukee emailed to ask how she can find a decent and reliable repair shop for routine services, especially for a car older than 10 years, rather than going to a dealership.
Ask your friends and family members where they go and how they feel about it. You know, it really is a word of mouth, just like any other service that you get. You want to have a good rapport with someone that you're going to take your car to, someone that's going to listen to you and not just try to sell you some products. I would talk to friends and family, people who live in the same area that you're in, so that you're getting some idea of what's going to be out there for what's available to you.
Ralph in Hayward has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Larry and Jim. Thanks so much for the show over the years. I've learned a lot listening to both of you. I have a question about gasoline, and it pertains to my 1994 Toyota 4x4 with a six-cylinder engine in it. And the question is, I know, Jim, you've talked about using, I think it's a product called Seafoam, numerous times over the years on the show. I use the truck periodically. It's just a baby with 175,000 miles on it. But I use it for things like hauling wood and deer hunting and going to the dump, so it doesn't get a lot of regular use. Would it be of any benefit to me to use premium gas for sort of more sporadic driving? What would you recommend?
No, I wouldn't use premium. Premium has to do with the octane and how it ignites in the cylinder when the engine's running. Premium gas can give you some advantages in certain engines. You might feel that you have more power with premium, but in terms of the vehicle sitting for a long time and the stability of the gas, that's not going to be based on that octane number. Gas has detergents in it that are meant to help prevent the fuel from breaking down, but over time that still will happen. It ends up getting, things separate, and what separates end up falling to the bottom and becoming gummy in wherever they're in your fuel system. So that's what you want to avoid. So I still think even if you put premium in it, you still are going to want to put some Seafoam in there so that it doesn't break down.
Yeah. Yeah. Ralph, there
and
you go.
And I wouldn't use premium in that vehicle. I don't think it's going to be a benefit to use it in the first place. So
John in Portage emailed to ask you, Jim, whether you'd recommend repairing a head gasket or change the motor on a 2013 Subaru Outback with 170,000 miles on it.
That's the kind of thing that's going to come down to what's available. Replacing the head gasket's an expensive job, and it is a job that is, if you haven't taken the engine apart, you really don't know yet what you're going to be doing. When an engine's together and running, you can see evidence that a head gasket has failed, but until you take the engine apart, you don't know if the head itself is warped, if the block is warped, if there's some other damage. So once that engine gets torn down, you may very well find that there's far more expense that needs to be done. You may find you have to replace the cylinder head, for example. And part of the equation is going to be what is out there in terms of replacement engines. You're not going to get a brand new engine for that. Your choices are going to come down to a used engine or a remanufactured engine. For a vehicle that age, I would be looking at remanufactured engines used engines. But it just depends. When you look at used engines, they can tell you what they're out of and how many miles were on them. And in an ideal situation, you can even find out the VIN number of the vehicle is in. So you can do like a Carfax and look up and find out, did that vehicle have good maintenance history on it? But if you can't find a used engine, then your choices start to become very limited. So it's going to take some research, but I wouldn't go into a head gasket job if the engine hasn't been torn down, assuming that it's just going to end with whatever was quoted for the head gasket replacement, because there's a lot of variables when you get in there. Usually what ends up happening in my experience is that it ends up getting replaced with a used engine if you can find one that's a good deal and that you'd want to put in it based on its history.
Jim, I understand you have a question for me.
Larry, I do. I do, I do. And I wonder, after talking with Wisconsinites every day for nearly 60 years, I wonder, what is something you learned about people that surprised you when you started and that you still believe today?
Oh, boy. Well, one thing that surprised me right off the bat was that so many people were actually willing to call in and ask questions. They weren't afraid to ask questions of you or any of the other guests. It's you know, the phone lines. I was amazed when the first show that I ever did, the call-in talk show, that the phone lines, we had 8 lines at that time, and they all lit up almost immediately. And they stayed that way, and that's still the case today. And I guess one of the things I've had an opportunity to do is go around the state and talk to people and give talks with Jill Nadeau. And afterwards, we always have a picture-taking session. And then and usually there's several hundred people that want to have a picture with me, and they will always, almost always say, you know, I remember that show and this when you did this, and I learned that particular point, and it stuck with me for all these years. So not only are they calling, but they are, and continue to call, but they are remembering certain points that were made that were of benefit to them. And that's always given me a really good feeling to know that we've,
sure.
They're not afraid to call, and they learn something when they do call.
Yeah. And, you know, you have filled a need. People out there need help, you know, and they're, whether they're willing to ask for it or not, there are people out there that are willing to help. And your format, I mean, I had done some radio a little bit before I'd ever been on your show, but you were the gold standard. And, you know, I tell you what, I'm just glad you're on your end doing what you do. I've been in the studio before, and anymore, I usually choose not to be in the studio because I just want to focus on the question that I got to answer and not think about all these calls and all the things you're dealing with on your end. It's amazing what you do.
Well, it's been a real pleasure working with you, Jim, over the years. I hope we run into each other down the road. And if I got a car problem, I may just send you an email.
Well, absolutely. Reach out anytime. Happy to talk to you about anything, whether it's a car problem or anything else.
Jim, thanks very much. Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota with the company for 36 years. He just does an outstanding job answering your questions and mine, too, for that matter. I've learned a lot from having him on the show, and it's much appreciated. And I hope he'll still do that, keep on the show after I'm gone and Lee Rayburn takes over. In the meantime, I've still got a few more shows to do and one more segment for this program, and I've been looking forward to this segment as well. There's a friend of mine, actually, Robin Shepherd, has written yet another book. He's written several of them relating to beer, and this one is titled A Keg of Their Best, Brewing in the Beer State Capital. That coming up next with Robin Shepherd. I'm Larry Mueller. Maybe it comes as no surprise, but you might be surprised to know that more than 70 breweries have operated in and around Madison since the 1840s. And every year, more breweries seem to pop up. Some go away, but many pop up as well. And there's a new book that documents all of them. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Robin Shepherd. Here to talk about his book. It's titled A Keg of Their Best, Brewing in the Beer State Capital, from the Beer Baron Era to Modern Microbrews. And Robin comes with a whole lot of knowledge. He's, for 20 years, he's written about beer for the Madison alternative newspaper, Isthmus, also an assistant dean for UW Extension, faculty member in my home department, so we're actually faculty members from the UW Madison's Department of Life Sciences Communication. He's got a fun and interesting book, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. What's your favorite Madison area beer or brewery or brew pub? Is there a brewery that comes and has gone that you miss and wish it was back? Give us a call. The number 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Robin Shepherd, welcome. Good to have you with us, Robin.
Well, it's great to be here. I'm honored to be kind of in this final chapter here, Larry, as you look at something else in your life. So.
Yeah, I'll be doing a lot of new things. I'll probably be sampling a beer here and there along the way, as you and I have done on occasion.
Well, like your last guest, you said that you might call him for car advice. You can call me for beer advice anytime, Larry.
Okay. Well, this... what is it about beer and brewing that continues to fascinate you?
Well, for me, I love storytelling. You know, I love the kind of investigating and hearing about the fascination of beer from others. And I kind of when I came up through our home department, what I missed when I became an academic was that storytelling, that writing, that creative writing side of it, Larry. You know, the academic writing is a little different. It was also at a time when home brewing was, you know, everywhere, and yeah, it was the early days of the craft beer movement in Madison. I wanted to write. I found myself missing that because I had been a news reporter for about 12 years before I came up and joined academics. And I think beer was my muse, to tell you the truth. You know, I was looking for something to write about, and I was involved and immersed in the homebrew culture, and I had a lot of friends doing it. And so that's how I got started in it. And the dynamics of the industry today, there's always a story in every glass. There's a story behind every bar. There is constant turnover in today's craft beer world. And so there's always another story to tell.
Yeah, well, you've done a great job with this. I found it really fascinating, the history, the early history of the breweries in Madison and the Madison area. There were a lot of them.
You know, we get sort of caught up in today's craft beer world that we tend to forget that those folks are on the backs of a lot of people before them, right? And not a lot had been documented in the way of the pre-prohibition breweries in Madison. And when I started kind of getting into it, I started learning about the stories of the breweries. My other books had been more travel logs, travel guides of finding them with little short vignettes. And what I found myself was really getting lost down those rabbit holes of, well, who was this brewer? What was his family like? What were some of the other things were happening in Madison at the same time? So pre-prohibition-wise, Madison had, and Madison in the proper Madison, it had about eight that were active breweries from the late 1840s all the way until Prohibition. One survived. That was the Fauerbach Brewery. But fascinatingly, as you get further into kind of looking at the history of this, that there's another kind of level or layer of breweries called farmstead breweries that dotted Dane County. And these were breweries that were part of a farm operation, just like you would have, you know, hogs or chickens, or you made butter and milk and sold that as a commodity. Well, some brewers had a brewery on their farm.
Yeah.
And I was able to locate eight of those in Dane County. And there's not much record of those breweries. You find yourself sort of painstakingly going through old plat books from the 1800s to look and see if there's the word brewery anywhere.
Well, you know, I was really fascinated of the Fauerbach. And they, I think it's before Fauerbach, wasn't it Sprecher?
Yeah, Sprecher was the first brewery to happen in Madison. Adam Sprecher came to Madison right as we were becoming a state. He arrived in 1848, and statehood was that summer. Sprecher started brewing in the fall. Sprecher's brewery was along Lake Monona. So if you think of where the Capitol is, that's a good visual reference, I assume, for most people. You just go to the north and east of there, about a quarter of a mile along the lakeshore. His brewery was very small, even by today's standards. By today's standards, it's really small. But he brewed in not much more than, I think, a livestock tank. kind of arrangement. But over the years, he operated that brewery for about 10 years. It grew. Eventually, he built a nice brick building for his brew house. And as you find in a lot of community-type settings where a brewery exists, the family lived above the brewery, that kind of stuff. So Sprecher, that brewery actually gave rise to Fauerbach. One of the really interesting stories, if I can indulge you for a minute, Larry, is just that Sprecher started his brewery in 1848, and he unexpectedly died in around 1860. So he operated it, about 10 years. And when he died, he left behind a wife, a 10-year-old daughter, and a 2-year-old boy. So Margaret, his wife, was primarily the owner of the brewery at that time, but her sister was married to another brewer in Portage. His name was Carl Hartle. And so Carl Hartle ended up being probably the most influential brewer in Madison and didn't even have a brewery here because Hartle helped arrange for someone to rent the Sprecher Brewery. And he did that for 8 years, and then Margaret Sprecher dies unexpectedly, leaving behind the daughter and the son. The son was 10, and the son inherited the brewery. Wisconsin's youngest brewery, I'm willing to stand behind that statement. At 10 years old, he was the youngest brewery owner in Wisconsin history. But his uncle stepped in again as guardian. The child moved to Portage and grew up with Hartle, and Hartle again arranged for a renter, and he turned to his brother-in-law, Peter Fauerbach.
Yeah.
And Peter Fauerbach rented it for 10 years until Reinhardt, the young Reinhardt Sprecher, was old enough to make his own decision at age 21. And young Reinhardt said, no, I don't want to be a brewer, and sold it to the Fauerbach family.
Peter Fauerbach?
Peter Fauerbach was the original.
Yeah.
Peter Fauerbach of today, which you may know that name, he's his fifth generation from that Fauerbach. But Peter Fauerbach took the brewery and turned it into Madison's, most successful, longest-running brewery. It was in existence until 1966.
Fauerbach CB Beer. I can remember that well. And the Fauerbach family, interesting thing to me as I read that part, was they were kind of leaders in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, their brewery, I believe, was a leader in refrigeration. It was one of the earliest commitments to bottling. During Prohibition, they went into the soda soft drink business, and even coming out of Prohibition, their soda business was so successful they ended up purchasing a Pepsi Cola franchise and ran it for many years, and it became one of the plums in the business when the business was sold in the 60s.
Yeah, it is an amazing story. And, we've been zeroing in directly on Madison. But what the other thing that I really enjoyed about looking at the history with all these other towns, like Mazamani, and there's things you learn. I mean, I didn't know how Mazamani came to be and a town like that. And what the Mazamani Brewery was about, I didn't even know that.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's so many interesting things about these communities.
Exactly. One of the enjoyments in writing a book like this, or a book that goes back into history, for me was getting to know those local historians in those communities. I just went out and visited with, there are a lot of these smaller historical libraries or museums or societies, and they have passionate people that have written wonderful summaries about some type of activity or business in that community. I got to know Frank Wolf in Mazamani, and he had written, I think, a book called Mazamani Boomtown. And it was about how Mazamani came to be. And, getting to sit down with him for an afternoon, those kinds of experiences go well beyond just having a beer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that was one of the most enjoyable kind of side benefits of doing historical research.
Our guest today is Robin Shepherd. His book is titled A Keg of Their Best, Brewing in the Beer State Capital. It's great talking with him. If you have a question or maybe an experience to share, maybe about a brewery in your area, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. Email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us as we talk with Robin Shepherd about his book, A Keg of Their Best, Brewing in the Beer State Capital. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. You talked about the youngest brewery owner at the age of 10. And there was another guy that you write about or talked about was Otto Curl.
Oh, what a wonderful kind of unexpected surprise when you fall into that rabbit hole of of trying to track down who was where and who was married to who and how did they get there. Otto Curl, he had a farmstead brewery just north of Cross Plains. And Curl had grown up in Germany, and he was lucky enough that he got to go to college and he studied homeopathic medicine. Now, keep that in mind. I'll come back to that in just a second, Larry.
Yeah.
All right. So but his family really wanted him to have a different life. And so it was arranged for him to come to America. And this was, at the time, it was a long investment to come across the ocean, right? 40 days to sail across the Atlantic. And midway through the Atlantic, the ship is hit head on by a horrendous storm, and the ship's main mast breaks. And so Curl, who's 29 at the time, he and the ship's carpenter brave the storm, go out on deck, were able to lash down and hold onto the mast and repair some of the ship and keep it from sinking. Okay. So when he gets into the New York Harbor, he's slotted as a hero for obvious reasons, okay? When he gets into New York, he's not really a brewer at that point. So he takes a part-time job and learns brewing. And what he really wanted to do was to come to the frontier, the interior North America at that point. And so he finds a way to get through the Erie Canal and into the Great Lakes, lands in Milwaukee, and virtually walks from Milwaukee to Madison, where he'd heard there's great opportunities, a wonderful landscape. One of the first people he stumbles across in the 1848 was he walked into Sprecher's Brewhouse. There's a couple of great descriptions. He referred to Sprecher as an old man. Well, keep in mind, Curl was 29, and Sprecher was 28. So from there, he embarks. He got a little advice, I assume, from Sprecher. And then so he heads he goes on to the West and finds a farm in the Cross Plains area where he goes about building a farm and builds a brewery within the farm. And for 10 years, he operated the brewery. When in the 1860s, when he decided to kind of hang up the brewery, he continued to farm. But what Curl really was known for, and all of this that, I tell you about him being a hero and he starts his farm brewery, the homeopathic medicine stuff was what everybody knew him by. And they all called him Doc Curl. And he would treat whatever it was. People would come and see him from miles away for his homeopathic remedies. And it got to be so popular that he kept sending back to Germany for these herbs and things that he was using. And the guy must have been an incredible farmer because he never charged for his service.
Oh, my gosh.
But he treated all the neighborhood, all the surrounding farmers when their ailments with whatever. And so the community, they never really knew him as a brewer. They knew him as Doc Curl, and that was what was in his obituary. But anyway, the point that you raised about it, a fascinating story about getting lost in that rabbit hole of history and coming up with, wow, is this right? I mean, he saved the ship at sea?
Tim in Naples, Florida has something for us. Let's go there. Tim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Larry, first of all, I'm going to miss you. I've lived in Naples for 10 years, but have lived all over the country, and I'm going to miss you so much. I listen to you every day.
Oh, thank you.
So this story takes, let's go back to the early 80s, right? UW Eau Claire, it would become the end of the month, and we would run out of fuel oil, so we had to send we had to say, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to heat the house first at Eau Claire, and then we have no money left for beer. So we would drive 10 miles to the Leinenkrugel Brewery. At the time, it was just a garage. We opened up the garage door. There was a courtesy tap. You could spend an hour there and just drink beer for free. You had to wash your own glass, and then we would leave. And some of the gentlemen I attended with, you would probably recognize the name Kinetter, and also, you know, Manitowoc companies. So major players in the state of Wisconsin. But we had so much fun, and Leinenkrugel's saved us. And look at them today.
Right, yeah. You know, the Leinenkrugel family, I mean, we think of them all as Chippewa Falls, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's the one that made the family famous. But before that, the father, Matthias Leinenkrugel, had a brewery in Sauk City, which is 35 miles north and west of Madison, right?
Yeah.
So that was where the family kind of got its brewing start. And so Jacob Leinenkrugel was one of five sons, and Jacob was the one that made Chippewa Falls famous, but his brother, it was Heinrich, and his brother was, it seems like, was an antagonist with George Esser, Esser's Best.
Yeah.
That's the brewery that kind of was built around Cross Plains. And so in the 1860s, George Esser was looking for a place for his farmstead brewery. And he actually looked at Madison's Capital Brewery, not to be confused with today's Capital Brewery, but Capital Brew was originally located right smack in the middle of the isthmus. And he looked at buying that beer or that brewery, and its price was too steep. And Esser actually bought farmland for a brewery outside of Eau Claire, which would have taken the Esser family and everybody to make their brewery outside of Eau Claire, right? But if it wasn't for another Leinenkrugel, one of the brothers beat him to the punch. All right. And so he said, I'm not going to go and plop another brewery down there. So I'm going to look at Cross Plains. And then one of the other brothers, Heinrich, starts saying, well, if you're going to do that, I'm going to look for a brewery in Cross Plains too. And so there was this little bit of a race to see who could construct the brewery first. And Esser won. But so it's really kind of fascinating if you stop and think about how that twists in history. Could that have convinced the Leinenkrugel empire to be right outside of Madison on the doorstep? Maybe.
I've got a canoe paddle from Leinenkrugel's. It was presented to me on my 50th year on the air. And it's sitting in my living room, and all the Leinenkrugel guys, brothers, signed it.
Oh, nice.
So
nice.
A friend of mine, Bob Bozell, gave me that for a 50-year gift, which I enjoy very much. Yeah. You know, there's so many stories. I can remember interviewing Deb Carey from New Glarus when they were just getting started with their brewery. And you have a piece on them, certainly, and it's just another time era. But.
Right. Well, you can't tell the story of brewing, and not just craft brewing, but you can't tell a story about Wisconsin brewing and not include the New Glarus Brewing Company. You know, it's one of the largest craft brewers in the country. When you look at the amount of craft beer that's produced, I think the 2025 barrelage figure showed that of just the Wisconsin barrelage from craft brewers, Wisconsin or New Glarus Brewery accounts for nearly 40% of that. You know, and we all know about the famous Spotted Cow.
Yeah.
And how that is iconic. What's fascinating, though, is for me as a beer person, the so-called beer geek in me comes out, and that New Glarus is known for so much more than Spotted Cow. Spotted Cow's a great beer. I'm not going to argue with anybody over that. But, you know, the Careys were really, they were ahead of the curve on sour beers. You know, sour beers have been coming everywhere at us in the craft beer world. They were some of the first to actually do sour beers on what's called sort of mixed culture, which is wildly fermented beers. Brewers today can kind of do things like souring their kettles and using yeast today that will give you some sour flavors. But the Careys were really early innovators in the movement to recognize sour beers in the modern craft age. Not to mention, just go online and look at their beer portfolio. It's so deep and rich.
Well, the I have a former, well, brother-in-law, friend, who lives in Georgia, and when if I go to visit there or he comes up here, he has to have, I have to take him some Belgian red.
Oh, that beer, Larry, is currency in the brew world. I will travel with a bottle of Wisconsin Belgian red almost all the time because you can't get it anywhere than Wisconsin. And if somebody knows I'm from Wisconsin, if they're a beer person, that's the first beer they ask me about. And I can trade that for some serious stuff.
Well, you know, Door County cherries.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was amazing. Well, there are great stories. There's some sad stories a little bit. I think Ale Asylum is one of those that comes to mind as a, I mean, they're Hopalicious beer, but they, well, you certainly write about that.
Right. I mean, when you think about the craft movement, it's a little bit of booms and busts throughout, but we saw tremendous growth in the 1990s, and there was a little bit of, a correction there where about as many would come on as about, it would equal the number that would be failing or closing down in the 90s. Then in the early 2000s, the craft beer movement was catching so much steam that we saw a new regional class of breweries come online, which were those were capable of, you know, their target goals were 20,000 barrels a year plus. That's quite a bit
that's
of beer.
That's a lot of beer.
Yeah. New Glarus, keep in mind, makes 250,000 barrels a year, but that's just the perspective of what they were. But they were angling for wider distribution, statewide distribution. And so there was a lot of investment in that. And the growth curve through much of the early 2000s until about 2015, our local breweries were seeing double-digit percentage growth in them. So, and Ale Asylum was on that early cusp. They were the, you know, rock stars in the brewing world. And then around 2015, quite a few more breweries came online, and the markets began to get tightening up. And if you were basing your projections on double-digit growth, it was beginning to slow. And so you had to be careful where your investments had been, what your lease payments were and all of that. And I'm not pointing a finger directly at Ale Asylum because I don't know their finances, but I think there was a slowing in around 2015 that we saw the first wave of craft brewers really starting to go under, or that generation begin to go under. And then along came COVID. And drinking habits changed. Not only drinking habits, but the way we interacted with things. And that was a new paradigm for a lot of breweries. I will say that in our period in Madison during COVID, surprisingly, we did lose breweries, but we also had new ones come in at about the same rate as the ones that were leaving, as the number that were leaving. But it's a different market today. We see a lot more smaller breweries. Those breweries built for 20,000 barrels, those aren't happening right now.
Well, I tell you, you have written just a fascinating history of this area and its beers and the people that were there, the stories. You told a couple of them today, but there are many, many more stories in the book, and I wish we had more time to talk about it, but Robin, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed the book, and I know a lot of people will. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. It's been a pleasure being your friend over these years, and I hope that's going to continue.
Oh, I hope so, too.
To our next beer, right?
There you go. Robin Shepherd, our guest. His book is titled A Keg of Their Best. Subtitle, Brewing in the Beer State Capital from the Beer Baron Era to Modern Micro Brews. Really interesting read, and I hope you have a chance to get a copy and take a look at it. Tomorrow, Patty and the guys on for Garden Talk and Susan Carpenter as well. Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.